I would always ask people that work for me, especially when it got really hard, like, you have to know your why. And if your why's strong enough, you'll keep moving forward. And maybe it's just a good paycheck, or maybe it's a great industry. It doesn't really matter what your why is, but I think that's what drives you forward.
Welcome to Re-Energize.
This is a podcast about renewable energy.
Yeah, we know what you're thinking. Another duo of clean tech bros wonking out on energy policy.
Think again. This is about your energy.
How do you find peace on the emotional roller coaster of renewable development? How has this work transformed you?
We ask these questions together with people who have lived it.
Plug in.
It's time to re-energize.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Today, we are very fortunate to be joined by Sarah Hetznecker, who is a solar industry veteran and pioneer who has seen more cycles in this industry than Jay and I, perhaps maybe even combined. She's an accomplished executive and leader in this space. There just simply aren't that many people out there who have this kind and level of experience. So her career has spanned just about everything, project development, value chain. She's been an EPC provider. She's worked at a lender, you know, to owner operators. She's been providing unique insight into how each sector operates and the specific needs of their operational models. So she's basically been doing it all in solar in the US for over 20 years. And Sarah, I think a few things have changed during that time. So you've seen a number of cycles, and when you can see that many cycles, you can really have a pattern recognition that is unparalleled. And so we're so lucky to have you. Sarah is also a mother who has raised three children, two of whom happen to be exceptional sons who Jay and I both know and have worked with, which is also a nice connection here. They couldn't help but follow their mother's footsteps into solar, and they happened to work with us at Community Energy for a few years. Sarah started her career as a geologist, and in 2002, she co-founded Mesa Energy with her husband, Gary Sheehan. This was an early-stage solar development company in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. 5 years later, she sold that company to Sun Technics, a Conergy company, and then she went on to serve the Conergy leader on the Conergy leadership team and work as the director of project development. Then in 2010, Sarah started a 5-year stint at the DOE Loan Guarantee Office, doing diligence on renewable energy projects and contributing to the financing of a high-value, first-of-its-kind, innovative technology to support renewable energy operations across the United States. In 2015, Sarah joined PSEG, one of New Jersey's main utility companies, on the unregulated side, where she developed, owned, and operated utility-scale solar plants across the U.S. She was responsible for overseeing the operation of 25 solar plants. She also led the development of one of PSE&G's offshore wind projects. Subsequent to that, she joined GeneX Solar as the CEO in 2021, and she is now an independent consultant in the solar industry. Wow, that one took a little bit longer to get through. It's really impressive, just saying it out loud. Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah.
I feel like Forrest Gump. I just got lucky.
You just got lucky.
Well, thank you. That was a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Can you tell us how you got started in the solar industry? Like, what inspired you to start Mesa Solar back in 2002?
It was serendipity. I mean, actually, my husband and I had an environmental consulting firm, and much of the work that we both had done up until that time was hazardous waste site investigations, leaky underground storage tanks, buried drums. I did geophysical surveys. I drilled wells, sampled wells, wrote reports, analyzed data. You know, I felt like we had really begun to address the bad past industrial practices that led to environmental degradation. But the one thing that I felt that we hadn't really been looking at, or at least I hadn't in my career, was the sources and uses of energy and greenhouse gas emissions. And I was part of an organization, and we were doing a conference, an environmental conference. And I was helping one of the co-chairs to help set up that conference. And I said, we have to do a panel on energy. my co-chair and I looked around. We were like, where are we going to get speakers? And we found out about this little conference in Harrisburg called Getting to 10%. And the conference was really about trying to establish a renewable portfolio standard in Pennsylvania. And this was around 2000. So we went to the conference and met amazing people, wonderful people who were very committed to renewables. And it was a very fledgling industry, at least from what I could see. And I learned about this little solar grant program within my electric service territory. And I was like, my God, I've always wanted to have solar. I learned about solar when I was in high school. And I thought it was so incredible that, you know, these panels could sit there just doing nothing, collecting the sun's energy and then generating electricity. So I brought the information home to my husband, Gary, and he said, oh, I'll look into that for our house. So in the process of doing that, there were no installers in Pennsylvania. So they asked him to take the course to become an installer, which he did. And he became NAPSEP certified. And so the phone just started ringing. We brought solar energy to our little firm that was an environmental firm. It was just serendipity. We tried to give our clients more than they expected. And I think that our consulting background really helped us because we would go to every single house, do a site assessment. We used MapQuest, there was no Google Earth, and PV Watts to develop the output. And we put together like a comprehensive package on energy savings, all the components and what else. And then we prepared the grant application for them. So if they chose to move forward, they had everything they needed to make the decision. And along the way, we just met incredible people that were willing to help us, electricians that were willing to learn, obviously the state and the grant program that really helped us establish a foothold.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that with us. I want to ask a couple geeky questions if I can. So what year did you guys install the first panels on your house?
So that's a good question because our house was not the first one. We had to get suppliers to be willing to give us panels and inverters, and the supply chain was really tricky and sourcing was hard and a system was like $11 a watt at the time. It was really expensive, or $10. Yeah. And so actually the very first system that we did was for a guy in Chester County who had a system that he installed himself. He was someone that was very into solar, early adopter, had off-grid stuff. And so we worked with him. And then we had a winery that really wanted solar. And they were our first big client. And it was, I think it was a 5 kilowatt system, which was just like, oh my gosh.
Right. You know, right. Big. Yes. That's more than one panel.
Yeah. And the other thing is BP Solar had a manufacturing facility in Frederick, Maryland. And Gary was really smart in that he said, you know, we should just really work with one supplier, even though many times they didn't have what we needed because bigger installers got first choice. But that worked for us because they gave us favorable pricing terms and we were able to sort of build a program with them at one point. So it was a really good decision.
That's cool. What wattage were those panels at that time?
So the first panels were 150 watt.
Oh my God.
Wow. And so like we designed everything and then like 2 months later they were 160. So then we'd have to redesign. And then like another 3 months later, they were 175s and we were blown away. And then they were 180 watt modules. But we ended up putting on our house a 4.8 kilowatt system, roof space constrained, with battery backup because we were scheduled to do one at the Pennsylvania Governor's Mansion. And we were like, we have to do a prototype before we can install this at the Governor's Mansion. So that's what we put at our house. Yeah.
Wow.
And I think we had 175 watt modules.
Mm-hmm. For a 4.8 kilowatt system.
I think so. I'm doing my, yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. I just want to tip my hat there. I mean, for anyone listening, right, the projects have obviously gotten bigger. The supply chain, the modules have gotten, you know, the bin class has gotten way bigger. The supply chain is way more sophisticated. I mean, I'm imagining, Sarah, you're like calling some supplier, you know, and they're like, we don't do this yet, you know, like we don't send in this quantity to the United States or wherever. And you were trailblazing, right? And and it's cool to hear the energy in your voice as you talk about it, like just this blank slate and figuring everything out for the first time and, you know, like connecting it, like, is it going to work, you know, and then it works. But for anybody, for everybody in the industry today, you know, it's easy to like lose sight of the fact that we're standing on your shoulders, right? And everyone who came before, and it's a little bit easier when the trail's already blazed to maybe add some gravel or make it a little wider, you know, but like it's when you're going through the forest the first time, it's a little tougher. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I felt that way. Like we met amazing people at BP Solar who were in solar before BP started their solar manufacturing facility, who really helped. And that's the thing. That's one of the things about that I wanted to talk about is like this, it takes amazing people willing to try new things, get creative with a shared vision and be resilient. And I think, you know, those early lessons are still applicable today because we're actually going through a very similar phase.
I love that.
You just have to keep asking yourself, how can I find a way? And you find the people and the willingness to just keep going. And you have to shift, constantly have to change.
Yeah, the world keeps changing, so we got to change with it.
Yeah.
Jay, any more geeky questions?
No, I think that covers it for now. Maybe later.
Maybe later. Over a beer or coffee. Awesome. Well, Sarah, we'd love to ask you, you know, before we really dive into the, you know, into the story, you know, mm-hmm. give us just a brief, like, kind of preview, like in a couple sentences, like, what's the why? What is this experience about, and why does it matter?
Well, I'm actually, you know, it's funny that you started asking about those early days because I was going to go back to the early days and when nothing was easy and everything felt new and we didn't have a roadmap for ourselves, we just had a vision and a desire. And great people willing to help. So that was really it. It was about vision and desire. Yeah.
That's all. And can you tell us, just to set the stage a little bit, back in those early days where this story takes place or when the story takes place, what was going on in your life?
That's a great question. So I'd left my day job and we had just started this little environmental consulting firm. And we had, you know, some good clients and we had three kids in middle school. And it was a big leap of faith to not have the paycheck and the health insurance. But we believed in, you know, what we were doing. And so we just thought we've got to find a way to make this work for our family.
And you did, of course.
Yeah.
So
yeah. That's, fortunately. Thank God.
That's awesome. That's really cool. It sounds like it felt right. It just sounds like it felt right, but that leap of faith is really interesting, right? I mean, that's tough. Yeah.
I was scared. I was scared.
Scary, right?
Yeah. And it was a lot of work. I remember the first day that I wasn't working for someone else and we had our own company. And Gary and I went out to lunch and I was like, oh my God, I'm going out to lunch in the middle of the day. Like, I felt like I was on, you know, on vacation, even though I wasn't, you know, but it was just a great feeling.
Great feeling. That's awesome. Yeah. And I love that you did it with your husband. It's really awesome that you and Gary like did this together. That's really cool. Yeah. Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
That's really cool. So yeah, let's jump in. Love to hear you tell us your story.
Well, the story is really about the chaos and that shifting programs and supply chain and everything that we're seeing today. And then sort of how to just shift and adapt and get creative. And I think the biggest lesson for me out of all of it is just great people that are willing to, that share the vision and they're willing to help. Cause that's really what happened. So, you know, when we started doing solar, people said, oh, don't give up your environmental business. Within like a year, we had completely transitioned into solar because people wanted solar. There was a desire. So we hired installers and we went out and spoke to everyone that we could, municipalities, so they could understand about how to permit us, because there was no like permitting. And at that time too, most of the solar that we were aware of was net metered solar. So this stage of our company was really just rooftop net metered. We did municipalities, we did small businesses, we did homeowners, you know, schools, things like that, farms. Farms were very interested in solar because they understood the weather risk and they also believed in the money savings that they would achieve. So we transitioned to a solar company, and the PA market was really, really small in size. And as I said earlier, you know, the supply chain for solar was really bumpy, probably is bumpier than we've seen in the past 10, 15 years. That has not changed, I'll tell you. And then the PA solar program started to become fully subscribed, and we're like, oh my gosh, we have got to diversify. So it was one of those moments like, holy crap. And fortunately, our neighboring state, New Jersey, had a really robust solar grant program and RPS. So we were able to open an office in New Jersey and get licensed in New Jersey. And we began, you know, building a very strong pipeline in New Jersey, which was really wonderful for us. And we got involved in all kinds of different programs with BP Solar. They started selling modules out of Home Depot, and they would assign installers to take on certain stores. So we had some good leads for new customers. And that's why, from my perspective, like that early partnership with them established a good relationship. And they also knew that we were going to deliver, because it was hard to deliver back then. So then the New Jersey program halted because they wanted to redesign the incentives. And so we thought, you know, we got to do something here. Wouldn't it be cool if we could have our own program? Like, how do we do that? And so the Department of Agriculture at the time in Pennsylvania was the fifth largest industry. And one of our farm partners came to us, and again, good people, supporting, creating, having the vision and helping you. And they said, why don't we partner and get a grant from the Department of Agriculture in Pennsylvania? So we devised a program and we called it Energy Farmers, and we got funded and we brought renewable energy. At that time, we wanted to be a full service renewable energy company, biogas, small wind, solar thermal, solar PV. So we do assessments, and we brought renewable energy assessments and installations to, I forget how many farms, but quite a few. And it kept our business going. It kept our installers busy. And it was just, you know, it saved us at that time. Crazy thing is that despite the chaos of all the programs and the lack of grants, our phones kept ringing off the hook and we kept doing assessments. And there was a tremendous interest in behind the meter solar, from very small to very large. But as you both know, it didn't always pencil because of the expense at that time of the components, not just the modules, but everything. So we got a call from a business in this huge repurposed manufacturing building in Philadelphia, and they wanted solar. So we went out and did an assessment, and the roof was so huge, it could hold 6 megawatts. And we were my God, 6 megawatts of solar. This would be really awesome.
Right.
And this really changed the trajectory of our company. So the owner of the building was also very interested in leasing that rooftop, you know, looking to generate more income from his existing footprint. And the only problem is we needed offtake. So we knocked on all the tenants' doors, again, the net metering mindset. And the length of the net metering agreements that we would have to do didn't match the lease terms.
Yeah.
And there was too much risk for everyone involved, and the owner of the building wasn't willing to open the lease terms, and rightfully so. At the same time, the state of Pennsylvania was looking to attract one of the largest renewable energy companies at the time, Conergy, to the U.S. and headquarter in PA. And so they were doing a lot of meetings with them, and they introduced us to Conergy. And we loved what we saw because they were a full-service renewable energy company. And we thought they could bring us the capital and resources, engineering expertise that we needed in order to do that. They liked what they saw in our pipeline and some of the things that we had done. So at first we were going to partner, and then we merged. And that was great because we now had sort of the capital, the engineering muscle, the supply chain, because they were making their own modules behind us. And we were just absolutely, it was like amazing to us at the time. But the merger, you know, had some challenges. And I think the biggest one at the time was they were used to feed-in tariffs in Europe. And understanding our sort of patchwork of programs and rules and laws and RPSs was really challenging to educate them on that. But they did finally understand. So back to the 6 megawatts. So we needed to obtain offtake.
Okay.
So we're still having that problem because we weren't going to reopen the leases. And at that time, you know, there was very, at least to my knowledge, there were very few utility scale solar plants with third party offtake. There were the two that I knew of at the time were the SEGS plants in California that were solar thermal plants that were built in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And the other was, I think, a 6 megawatt plant that was built at Nellis Air Force Base. And then I think they later expanded that plant to like 14 megawatts. And we didn't know much about project finance or utility solar, but again, along the way, we just met some wonderful people with a shared vision and creatively trying to make things work. We were introduced to an IPP, or the merchant side of a big utility, and they were already doing a lot of wind deals, which I'm sure you guys were aware of at the time with community energy. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, let's have a meeting. Let's sit down, show us the hourly output curve for the year. And we did. And they were interested. They said, maybe we can make this work. So we did some pro formas. And in 2007, it just barely penciled. And it was like eking through. We thought maybe we could make it work. So we started putting together a PPA framework. So, everything was coming together. It was like incredible. We couldn't believe it. It was just like, how did this even happen? And then we started looking at permitting and doing a more, a further design for that roof and looking at the interconnection details, application, et cetera. And we did a structural assessment of the roof. And guess what happened? It needed hundreds of thousands of dollars of augmentation to make that roof actually hold the panels. Right. So when we ran the numbers, the project didn't pencil anymore. And literally, we thought the project was going to collapse. And we were just like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? So again, through like really great people who had a shared vision, who were willing to help figure it out, the PADEP, Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, introduced us to some folks. And there was one landfill owner who had some space adjacent to a landfill. And at that time, it seemed way too risky to do anything on a landfill. Everyone was like, oh no, you're going to have settling. You cannot do it on the landfill. So we found space adjacent to the landfill.
Sarah, I want to keep hearing this. I just have a question here. A moment ago, when you were saying, when you found out about this additional hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you're like, crap, and you think this has fallen apart, was this like one project of many? Was this like, oh gosh, the whole year was riding on it? I just want to get a sense of the stakes.
Absolutely.
The whole year. That's what I thought.
Our credibility was riding on it, you know. I mean, it happened early enough, but I mean,
yeah,
it was, yeah, it was a critical piece of the puzzle. And
we've all been there, right? When we find out something that we wish we knew earlier. I've been there. Yeah. I think the first episode was about that. Jay,
yeah, I think we heard a story about that.
I think we heard about that one.
I remember hearing that. Yeah. And I was like, I have a couple of those.
Yeah.
This is one of them. And especially when everyone was so willing to come together and make things. And so fortunately, we found another site through goodwill, great people, willing partners, and the landfill owner was willing to do the long-term lease that we needed, and the off-taker was willing to move the site. And so the project was saved, and it was amazing. And now this was early 2007, and the ITC was expiring at the end of 2007. So we had everyone everywhere doing everything all at once to try to make sure we had the permits pulled, the project finance in place, the final design, the modules that we need, all the components that we needed, and we needed to hire union contractors. So we had to get all those contracts in place, and it was a scramble and it was scary.
So Sarah, just a bit, let's pause on that for a moment. So you had to bring the project online, place in service by December 31st. Of course, it's always a cold month. Yeah, like December 31st of 2007. And if you don't do that, what percentage of the economics at that point you lose?
It wouldn't have worked. Like, I mean,
it wouldn't have worked. You lose whatever.
Not at all.
Yeah, you lose all the ITC. What was the schedule showing? You didn't have like a year of cushion, I'm presuming.
We had no cushion.
No cushion. So you're like, the schedule showing like December 25th or something, you know, you're going to have to be out there on Christmas, like building this thing.
Yeah. And all the smart people were saying, the ITC is going to get extended. It's going to get extended. Don't worry. It's going to, but you know, you have to change ownership before the end of the year.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, like, on December 31st, we had already completed the project. We made the deadline. If I remember correctly, I do think the ITC was then extended for another year, but we didn't know that was going to happen.
You didn't know that. And you can't wait. If you're going to start building the project, you're putting, it's too late. You can't wait to see if it's extended. So you got to take on the risk.
Yeah.
Take that deep breath and hope for the best, but plan for the worst, right? Yeah.
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 And fortunately, you know, all the stakeholders were willing to. I mean, even the financing, because I think today you'd be hard pressed to get someone to finance a project like that with that kind of risk.
For sure. Wow. Sarah, it's so inspirational to hear you tell this story, because my career is kind of based on the work that you did. And I'm sitting here because of that, and Joel too. The audience can't see you, but we're able to see you and kind of see your eyes light up, you know, as the 6 megawatt opportunity comes up. And we also know, like, at this time, as you said, you have 3 kids in middle school, and you know, both you and your husband are riding this exact solar coaster ride together.
There's not a lot of other jobs. Yeah, that's right.
So I'm wondering what that was like to sort of do the work during the day, and I'm sure well into the night many times, but also both together having to be raising a family and supporting a family. Can you tell us what that was like for you?
Yeah. First, I just want to say thank you so much for your kind words. I really, really appreciate it. That's really meaningful. What was it like? It was exhilarating. It was exhausting. It was scary. But the great thing is, Gary and I had each other's backs, which was really wonderful. And I can't say enough how we were surrounded by amazing people who really did so much. And it's funny, when the kids were younger, when we first started our business, you know, that we'd drive someplace and they go, oh, look at that rooftop. That's a good rooftop for solar. There's a good solar roof. So it was, and they'd come and work and help us do things in the office, which was also really fun and great, great to have. So, yeah, it was.
That's awesome. And then they went on to actually sell solar rooftops.
Yeah.
To others, right? So,
that's
cool to see. My dad was a dentist, and he brought his work home sometimes in pictures, and I would see those pictures and I knew that I never wanted to be a dentist. Your kids saw the work that you did, and I imagine the exhilaration that you mentioned, you know, that excited them. That's so cool. And, you know, you've talked a lot about some of the great people that surrounded you. It's just, I'm picturing this just community of people, and some of whom we probably know and have run into over the years in this industry, being in the same geographic area.
Yeah.
But, you know, how much that, you know, good people doing good work draw good people to them and, you know, build that community. And it just sounds like you were really able to do that through your vision and your excitement for this industry.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And I think too, just climate change, you know, when I first learned about that, which I hate to tell you when it was, because then you'll know how old I am, but you can Google that. Anyway, it was 1980. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh my God, this is horrible. But there was no movement to do anything about it. And I think, I think President Jimmy Carter installed solar on the roof and then at the White House, and then Reagan came in and took them off, and solar was dead. So I never imagined that I would actually end up, you know, having a career doing this. And for me, it was just very meaningful to try to make or contribute in any way to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and leave a better planet, really. I know that sounds corny, but yeah. That was a driving factor.
It motivates so many of us and our audience and the people that we work with. So we totally get it.
I knew you would, because I see that in both of you. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reminded as you're talking here, Sarah, of that Margaret Mead quote. It goes something like, never doubt that a small group of committed individuals can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has, you know, and so it's cool to see. It's like, just imagine, like, you lay down these foundation pieces and then others kind of build on top of it. And I'm wondering, like, Jay, to Jay's question of, like, it's interesting, by definition at that, because the path was so unclear when you got started in these early days, it kind of just attracted, I think, like a certain type of person who was comfortable with that lack of clarity, who's, you know, yeah, they knew they were going to had to make an earning, you know, and a paycheck, but it was, I don't know. Is this true that it was kind of like, it just naturally attracted people who were in it, like for the mission? Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a wonderful observation. I think that's really true. There wasn't, it definitely did. There wasn't as many, and nobody really knew what they were doing. So everybody was sort of figuring it out together. And then I would say, you know, maybe towards the late 2000, we started to, you know, have people coming out of college who had backgrounds in these things. And that was phenomenal, because then you could hire some really knowledgeable talent that could bring new ideas, new things, new to everything we were doing. But yeah, I think early days, it was
pretty magical. And I'm curious, like today where we are, this question for both of you, I don't know, I'd love to, where we are, it's interesting, it's scaled up, right? And so it's much more accessible for so many people. And that's wonderful. Like, this is what we always wanted to see, right? To get to that scale.
For sure.
And it's interesting, how do I frame this question or thought? Like, there's not going to be one mission for everybody, I don't think. Although I'd be curious to get your take. What I mean by that is, like, for somebody, the first and foremost mission might be, hey, provide a living for my family. For somebody else, it might be climate. For someone else, it might be safety. Like, I'm operating this plant and I want to make sure that nobody gets hurt, you know, while we're operating it. And I'd just be curious to hear you both kind of opine, or as you think about it, like, how do we, I guess the question I'm really asking is, like, how do we, as the tent has gotten bigger and so many more people are involved, How do we keep that soul? Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. How do we keep that soul and mission focus, and not be too rigid about it? But how do we keep that soul? Yeah,
it's a great question. I mean, I think a big part. You're right. Like, everyone has a different driving force that makes them do what they do, and I would always ask people that work for me, especially when it got really hard. Like, you have to know your why. So your question is really important, and if your why is strong enough, you'll keep moving forward. And maybe it's just a good paycheck, or maybe it's a great industry. It doesn't really matter what your why is, but I think that's what drives you forward. And also, I think just being resourceful and flexible, and things may not look like you think they're going to be. So maybe solar is transitioning, maybe it isn't, but find another way that meets your purpose.
Find your why. Find your purpose.
Find your why, find your purpose. Yeah.
That's great advice. So for me, Joel, it's always been about the projects. You know, there's something about that, seeing the steel in the ground, seeing the deals get signed, seeing the projects get done, which has been my shining star. I care about climate change. I kind of take that for granted a lot of times, that that's just kind of what we're doing. And obviously a paycheck is important, but the thing that gets me going every day is just, how do we get these projects in the ground and operating? And I think that's something that can bring people together with lots of different whys, because people have different reasons for kind of feeling excited, but everybody's like, hey, this is my thing. I'm in this. I'm doing this.
I love that. That's so true. Yeah. And I love that why. I mean, building something is incredible. That's going to last for a long time. That's a really great why.
Sarah, question for you, just in terms of, you know, kind of looking through the lens that you have, you know, you took us back really to the beginning of the solar industry in the United States almost.
Yeah.
You know, here we are, you know, 20 plus years later, as you said, kind of feeling a lot of the same challenges, supply chain, et cetera, et cetera. Do you find yourself often thinking back to those original days and sort of extrapolating and kind of using those lessons, or is it different now because of the scale of the industry or other things that have changed? How do the two connect for you?
That's today? A great question. I think that, I mean, the scale obviously is different, and there's a lot of money in the industry now. So there's a lot of risk around that, certainly. And as you said, there's so much uncertainty. So I think what I think about is, you know, how can we find a way or a hole or a niche that might be the bridge to take us back to what we want to do or something else? Because we may have to, you know, sidetrack for a bit and find a bridge, like we had to do with Energy Farmers, until we could bridge to the next thing. And I sort of feel like that's happening now. If the ITC goes away, I think that's going to create a lot of turmoil in the industry. But I do think there will be opportunities. We just all have to be resourceful and creative. And we'll still have chances to meet our why, you know, whether it be build something or climate change or whatever the why is, a paycheck or making sure plants operating safely. So that's what I think about. And I wish I had the answer right now. So what can we do next? How can we do this? I think we may have to find a bridge or take a T in the road, but a dog leg, but things will get back on track for sure.
So what I'm hearing is, it sounds like maybe the nature of the problems have changed in terms of size, scope, and our resources at industry have also changed. However, mm-hmm. What I'm hearing, something that has not changed about Sarah Hetznecker, is agility, belief that we can get it done, and gosh darn it, you know, and it's going to take resourcefulness, creativity, and pivoting to get there, you know, and that I don't know. That's what I'm hearing. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many smart people now. Like, I meet people and I'm like, whoa, especially younger people. Like, I don't think I was that smart or confident when I was younger at certain people's age. And I'm just blown away and impressed and in awe of the generation coming up. I really am.
They're a little more polished than we are. I think they're a little more prepared. Yeah.
I'm not polished now. I totally
I'm agree. Saying I'm not polished. Yeah. I'm not saying.
Well, they can learn from our mistakes.
That's good.
We hope. That's part of what inspired us to start this podcast. And we, as individuals, had to learn from our mistakes many times, and not even mistakes necessarily. I was talking to somebody today, And I was just saying, like, hey, man, you can't blame yourself for this issue you're dealing with. I mean, you look at the emails. You had every reason to believe everything was going fine. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, here you get, you know, punched in the gut. You know, don't take this home with you and think that you made this horrible mistake. Learn from it, of course, you know. But it's just...
That's a great lesson.
There's always something new. There's always something new, it seems like.
Yeah. And it's so nice that you had that perspective with this person because, I mean, sometimes people want to do the blame game. Hmm. And sometimes you can do everything you could think of and you still miss something.
Just not
enough. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's just not enough. That's right, Joel. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful that
something just comes out of the blue, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Sarah, it's been really wonderful talking with you. We're so happy to have been able to have this conversation, kind of hear about your business and how you got started and what you've learned. Are there any closing thoughts that you would leave here for our audience?
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you guys. I love your podcast and I'm really honored to be on it. I think we've kind of said much of the closing costs, like, I think you have to have good people around you. Project development isn't linear. There's always twists and turns and things that come out of the blue. But I think if you're willing to find a way and you have people that are willing to walk with you to find that way, you can make it work. And I think nothing's changed in the solar industry. It was that way when I started and it's still that way.
Yeah. You know? We're still talking about the ITC and schedules.
I know.
And
So and maybe that's why we all stay in it, because we love that adrenaline rush. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Keeps us on our toes. Yeah.
Yeah. That cortisol hit, you know, like
boom. Yeah, yeah. Let's get it done. Yeah. That's awesome.
That's great. That's great. Cool. So wonderful. It's great to talk with you.
For joining us on Re-Energize.
If you like what you hear, if you feel your energy rising, please pass this on to your friends.
And hey, you might have a story to share. If that's the case, you can reach out to us using our email address found in our show notes.